Author J.G. Ballard inspired Radiohead, Madonna, and hit it, Grace Jones.
See the breaking glass in the underpass. See the breaking glass in the underpass.
The news these days feels like a post-apocalyptic movie, all predicted by author J.G. Ballard, who died on Sunday. Positively Ballardian, a Kafkaesque Orwellian vision of a post-Dickensian age. This morning, a look at authors who become adjectives and how they got there were Byronically Shakespearean on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, April 21st. I'm John Hockenberry, and we've got a bookish show this morning with our good friend Patrick Henry Bass. It's a Bassian vision this morning in honor of the Pulitzers. Headline, African-American women took home two prizes. Also, we'll discuss some of the cases that are going before the Supreme Court this week, and we'll look back at the historical decisions that shaped our current economy. Who should we blame? Find out. Those stories coming up, but first, some headlines. Former Vice President Dick Cheney is adding his voice to those speaking out on last week's release of the CIA interrogation memos. He told Fox News that the harsh interrogation techniques work.
And there are reports that show specifically what we gained as a result of this activity. They have not been declassified. I formally ask that they be declassified now.
Cheney made his comments the same day President Obama visited CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, to explain his decision.
I acted primarily because of the exceptional circumstances that surrounded these memos, particularly the fact that so much of the information was public, had been publicly acknowledged.
The president reassured CIA employees he will keep his pledge to oppose prosecution of CIA interrogators. He was greeted at the agency by cheers. Femi Oke is here to help me out. What else is going on, Femi?
Hello there, John. California Congresswoman Jane Harman is denying charges that she interfered with an investigation into two pro-Israel lobbyists. They're now facing trial on espionage charges. Now, our partner, The New York Times, has reported that the National Security Agency intercepted telephone calls in which Harman agreed to seek lenient treatment for the lobbyists. It's unclear when the wiretaps actually happened. A new report out on the federal bailout program says that the program's private-public partnership is unfair to taxpayers and favors private interests. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner will address that report when he appears before Congress today. And the Somali pirate who survived the U.S. cargo ship hijacking appears before a federal court in New York. Abdul Dawali Musi is being charged with piracy and hostage taking. John.
Thank you. Jordan's King Abdullah is at the White House today. Bad day for Asian markets and Wall Street opens. Looks like a positive opening, but the S&P fell 4.3% yesterday. It begins trading at 8:32. What authors deserve an adjective?
This is Scotty from Teaneck. I'm voting for Faulknerian. I think Faulkner had a lot to do with a view of the South and a particular period of time that is timeless.
Author adjectives. Use your favorite one in a sentence and come up with some women, won't you, at 877-8-MY-TAKE?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Patrick Henry Bass is in the house. Coming up, a discussion of some very interesting book recommendations in honor of the Pulitzer Prizes, which were awarded yesterday, and some other surprises with Patrick Henry Bass. But we begin today with the Supreme Court. The court will hear arguments on two cases this week that will consider civil rights. Today's case considers a young woman suing her Arizona school district for strip searching her after she was suspected of having prescription-strength ibuprofen. The other will be heard tomorrow, brought by white firefighters and one Latino from New Haven. It's all about affirmative action. Here to discuss the Supreme Court cases and also what looks like a sort of tantalizing theme in the Justice Department under Eric Holder's approach to the court is Kenji Yoshino. He's the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Law at NYU Law School. He's right here in the Takeaway studio. Kenji, thanks for coming back to the program.
Thanks so much for having me again, John.
You know, let's talk about the specific facts of these two cases, and then I think the themes and the strategy and the sort of delicate relationship between the Justice Department and the court, at least in the glimpses that we have so far, is a pretty interesting discussion. First of all, the case that's going to be heard today.
Yes, that case is Safford versus Redding, and that's a case, as you said, where a 13-year-old girl was strip searched for having ibuprofen in middle school. So it's a classic Fourth Amendment search and seizure case, and the standard is generally reasonable suspicion. So what I find really interesting about this is that, on the one hand, you know, this just seems like a complete outrage. On the other hand, this is an outrage that has been upheld by courts in other states. And so the question was whether or not the school was on notice that it couldn't do this.
Is this the Supreme Court's first look at rights of search and seizure for middle school students and the state's interest in maintaining order in a school setting?
No, this has been a very, very long train of cases. The most relevant one with respect to public schools and kids and students has been this case called New Jersey versus TLO. And in New Jersey versus TLO, which is a 1985 case, what the Supreme Court said was reasonable suspicion means that you have to have some suspicion at the outset before you begin your search, and then the scope of your search has to be reasonable.
In general, the political sense about these cases, and, you know, watching cable television is perhaps not the best way of, you know, sort of sensing what the prevailing mood of Americans is. But I think there's a sense that, hey, these schools need to be tough to crack down on troublemakers, that sort of thing. How does that get translated into the doctrine of law here and protecting the rights of, in this case, a plaintiff who seems to have a pretty good case?
That's a great question. I think that the way in which the thumb on the scale gets put on for the school is through this reasonableness standard, which is A, contextual in nature, and B, it's kind of a term of art in the law for, you know, a very, very low level of review. So this is something less than, say, probable cause, which would be a much more stringent level of review that the school would have to pass.
Now, if they thought she was carrying a knife or a gun, maybe I could see, but ibuprofen?
Yeah, this is just completely outrageous. Essentially, what she's taking is 400, or what she was accused of having. They did not actually find this on her, was a 400-milligram tablet of ibuprofen, which a friend said that she had gotten from her. And so they were looking for more of it on her body. This is two Advils put together. I mean, so this is not something like ecstasy or, you know, any other kind of substance. But, you know, in the school's defense, the year before, you know, they had had this near-fatal accident for a kid who had brought drugs into the school. And also the school officials are not pharmacologists, so they can't sort of look at a pill and say, we know exactly what that is.
Right. And, you know, if students were drinking also in combination with other substances, it could be fatal. So you can see what the school's interest might be here. Let's move on to the affirmative action case. And then I want to get into this interesting sort of Eric Holder and the court Department of Justice story.
Absolutely. So in Ricci versus DeStefano, which, as you said, is going to be argued tomorrow, what we have is some white and one Latino firefighter filing a reverse discrimination case, saying they were discriminated against because they were not African Americans. And what the city of New Haven is saying in response is saying, look, what we had here was a test, a written multiple choice or written test, I should say. And what we discovered with the test was that it weeded out a vast number of African Americans. So, in fact, no African American would have been eligible for a promotion after this test.
Now, it's not as though that intent is in the test. Statistically, that's a consequence of the test, and it's noted after the fact. That's sort of the issue here, right?
That's exactly the issue, which is to say what the city is saying is this is a facially neutral test with a grossly disproportionate impact in a protected group, namely African Americans. So we believe that this test is flawed. Now, I want to underscore here that under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which is a federal law governing employment, if a test has a disparate impact, as it's known, on a protected group, the employer can only justify that if it's business related. And so if it has a business justification, so it has to be related to a business necessity. And so in this case, what we're trying to figure out is whether or not this test whether or not the decision not to use the test
right.
was simply an attempt to comply with that federal anti-discrimination law of saying, this is a discriminatory test. We don't want to use it, is what the city is saying. And the only reason we decided not to certify the results of that test is because we wanted to be in compliance with Title VII.
Whereas, so the plaintiffs are saying, hey, the test was fine. If it had been there, I would be a firefighter. What did you do this for?
Exactly right. And again, the stories are heartbreaking because one of these firefighters who was a white firefighter was dyslexic and he paid, you know, $1,000 to get this on audio tapes and he was studying. Another firefighter was in the hospital room when his child was being delivered studying away. And so they're very sympathetic plaintiffs in this case. And what they're saying is that the city is actually engaged in pretext. So they're pretending that, oh, we just want to comply with federal law. But what they're actually doing is saying we want to engage in racial balancing and we want to discriminate against whites.
All right. So let's take a look at the federal role here. The Justice Department has actually filed a friend of the court briefs in both of these cases, and they are by no means required to do so. This is plaintiffs versus defendants, and the court is sort of weighing in the middle. What do we see in these two friend of the court briefs as far as it suggests a style of Eric Holder, the new attorney general, and even more broadly, Barack Obama, who, as we know, Kenji, is a law professor, or was once a law professor before he got this card gig.
But we're not holding that against him, right, John?
Right, right. We're not. Absolutely not. Well, maybe we should. I don't know what you're going
to
say.
We should, but we're not. Well, what I'd like to say here is that I was sort of looking at these Solicitor General briefs, and what was really struck me about both of the briefs, which, as you say, were filed for the United States government, and as you also said, the United States government doesn't have to come in
right.
file of this friend of the court brief. What struck me as being common to both of them in both of these cases is that there's a real Obama-esque attempt to give each side its due.
To find a middle ground.
To find the middle ground, to find the common ground, but not in a kind of appeasement, kind of, oh, we're going to, you know, waffle here. It really is a very wise, sensible, intelligent reading of the law. And in both cases, they kind of split the difference. So let me go into specifics, just because I think it's useful to talk more concretely. In the Safford case, the strip search case, what they said is this going forward is unacceptable. You cannot do it. On these facts, you cannot strip search a 13-year-old girl.
That's what the government says.
That's what the government says. But we are not going to hold this particular school district liable because we have these other cases in Kansas, for example, and other states where
Declaring it unacceptable to strip search, but backing away from punitive actions against
that
the state
particular
authorities.
School. Yeah,
see.
Exactly. But going forward, like if Safford School District does this again tomorrow, then they're liable because now the law is clear, right? So essentially what the Obama administration is saying, let's forget the past, you know, let's make the law clear going forward, and then, you know, you have to abide by the law and so do all other schools. So that's their recommendation.
Very
to the
quickly,
court.
Quickly, what's the sense on affirmative action coming from the Holder Justice Department? And then I have a final question.
On the affirmative action thing, what the United States is saying is, look, this is not a legal question. This is a factual question. One side is saying that it didn't discriminate. It was just trying to comply with federal law. The other side is saying that was just a pretext for discrimination. Whether or not the city of New Haven is telling the truth is a factual question.
Uh-huh.
That's not a legal question. So send it back. Send it back to the jury.
Interesting. How influential is the Justice Department in bringing cases to the Supreme Court, in deciding what the Supreme Court actually gets to hear because it's so important in actually determining what cases actually make it to the Supreme Court?
As a formal matter, it is not in the sense that the ultimate decision rests with the justices themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens is that nobody has an appeal of right to the Supreme Court, which is to say that if I'm appealing from district court to appellate court, I have a right to be heard. If I'm appealing from the federal appellate court to the United States Supreme Court, I have to file a petition to be heard, and only a tiny percentage of those, less than 4%, are heard every year.
So they don't get to the front of the line, but the decisions, particularly if the government is involved, are often some of the weightier issues, even though, you know, sometimes they're not as well.
Exactly right.
Well, interesting stuff, and a great way of thinking about the cases independent of just the facts in the case. Two important cases being argued this week, helping us to explain them and put them in context. Kenji Yoshino, who is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU Law School. Thanks so much for coming down.
Thanks for having me.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Well, you know, in the course of preparing for work or wherever you're headed off to this morning, we got a treat for you. One of the problems of this show is that there's never enough time for all the great things that we talk about, and that specifically includes my time with Patrick Henry Bass, one of my favorite parts of this program. He joins us, Takeaway contributor and senior editor at Essence Magazine, is here for all kinds of book reasons, so I'm very excited. Good morning, Patrick.
It's always good to be here with you, John.
And, you know, the Pulitzers were announced today. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. And
That's
there's
right.
some very interesting sort of cultural headlines out of the Pulitzer announcements in books. But I got a quiz for you, all right?
Sure.
Are you ready?
All right, throw
can
it
you,
at me.
Can you handle it? Sure?
I think I can.
I mean, you know, you're an author of how many books?
Two, at least.
Yeah, so... And,
that I know of.
And you cover publishing in Essence Magazine.
Absolutely.
So, all right, what is the cultural reference? What is the theme, the thread that runs through all of these cultural references here? Madonna. It's a little obscure.
A crash.
Luminescent dash.
So high.
Fasten your seatbelt.
It's pretty hard. It's pretty hard. Any ideas?
No, I'm stumped.
Does this help you?
J.G. Ballard.
Nice. Very good. J.G. Ballard, of course. He died on Sunday at age 78. He is the common thread of all of those. That's Madonna. That's a group called The Normals.
That's
the
right.
David Cronenberg movie, Crash, which is based on a J.G. Ballard novel. He was a cult author. Very familiar to a lot of people, but described as a kind of a post-apocalyptic writer. He described his own work as looking at the psychology of the future. He's like a lot of authors. You know, Philip K. Dick might be described as one of these sorts of authors. But we honor him today because in the Collins English Dictionary, there is the word Ballardian.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's an adjective which, according to the dictionary, means resembling or suggestive of dystopian modernity, bleak man-made landscapes, and the psychological effects of technological, social, or environmental developments. For instance, like this, as he lost consciousness, Maitland caught a last glimpse of the passing traffic on the motorway. Between his attacker's swinging arms, he saw a red-haired young woman in a camouflage-patterned combat jacket running towards them with the metal crutch lifted in her strong hands. From Concrete Island.
I feel like I've been Hockenberry.
There you go. Of course, The Empire of the Sun was a famous Ballard novel that became
and a terrible
Spielberg movie. So the question really for us this morning is, what makes an author an adjective? Ballardian made it.
Right. Not so much Hockenberry quite yet.
No. Well, the Hockenberry's never going to make it.
Right.
So.
But one could be like Morrisonian. One can be
Morrisonian. Do people use Morrisonian?
Not yet, but we're going to make it up right now.
We're going to make it right now. Okay.
Let's call
Tony Morrison. Okay.
Right.
So Morrisonian would be what?
Morrisonian would be the intersection where complicated issues of race, sex, and gender all meet. Now, there's
or
also
maybe just really intense.
Exactly.
She was very Morrisonian.
I laugh a minute. There's also Faulknerian.
Faulknerian. That
Faulknerian
is real.
Is Southern Gothic, deep. You know, foreboding. Mysterious, rusty, backwoods.
Now, Tolstoyan, okay? I don't know if Leo would be happy about it because it doesn't really evoke anything other than huge, big, long.
Right, exactly.
Maybe boring.
And perhaps unread.
Ooh, ouch. How about Orwellian? That's a little
Orwellian,
bit like Ballardian, right?
Yeah, that makes a bit sense because we're talking about the future, you know, forecasting. One of my very, very favorite ones is Didionesque, yes.
Do people use Didionesque?
No, but we're going to do that.
We're
right
going to do that one.
Right
why don't women? I mean, there's no, you know, Kafkaesque, of course, the famous one.
Right, exactly.
And that's very specific.
Surreal,
yeah. But even beyond surreal is Kafkaesque. But why so few women? Austenesque, for instance, that evokes something for me. Jane Austen, of course.
Yeah, I think so. But I think it does have to do with the respect that women writers still are seeking. You know, I think there's something kind of Oatesian.
Well, Oatsy writes
so many books, you want to kill yourself. It's so prolific,
about this particular conversation. Yeah, and then you could sort of think there's the Erdichian.
Louise Erdrich, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah,
she's she was a runner-up for the Pulitzer. Actually,
she was a finalist, and it was a sad. I really wanted that book to win the Plague of Doves. Really?
Well, we'll talk about those in a moment. Why, for instance, does Kafka get it? Oh, Poe. It seems to me the word of the name itself is a problem. Poe does not have an adjective because you can't make an adjective out of the word Poe.
Yeah, but you could be Edgardian.
Dantean. There's one. Yes, that works well.
I like Bassian.
I bet you like Bassian. Yeah. But there are also some pop cultural, some real sort of low Runyon-esque is something Runyon-esque that's used, right? Damon Runyon, Guys and Dolls.
I like Baldwinian.
Baldwinian?
For James Baldwin.
Now, that sounds familiar to me.
Yeah. Have we used that before?
I think maybe.
Well, let's throw that out there. Let's call Webster's up the minute that this is over.
Well, the idea, of course, is to invite you into this discussion. And, of course, you're all very well read out there in the Takeaway audience. And what authors do you want to become adjectives? It's basically a sort of low-rent bid for immortality, which Patrick is apparently desperate for because he's voting for Bassian this morning. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at the Takeaway. .org. The idea is we need some women in there, women adjectives, right?
Yes.
We need Mosley-esque. How about that?
Absolutely.
Walter Mosley?
Right.
Does that work?
That works for me.
All right. 877-8 My Take, MyTake at thetakeaway.org. We're rolling with Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence. And we're already getting some good adjectives. Tell us yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we now check in with Femi Okeh, who has the headlines.
Thanks, John. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner faces questions about the TARP bailout plan today when he appears before the Congressional Oversight Panel. But a government report to Congress says that the plan favors private investors and could be unfair to taxpayers. The program's Special Inspector General issued a 250-page report warning that the Obama administration's plan could expose taxpayers to major losses. In his first full cabinet meeting, President Obama told his cabinet heads to cut $100 million from their administrative budgets, but Senator Mitch McConnell says that's not enough.
Just to put $100 million in context, that's what we spend per day on the interest on the stimulus package that we passed a month ago.
One idea was to cut costs by stop creating new seals and logos for the Homeland Security programs. In California, Congresswoman Jane Harman says that she did not interfere with an investigation into two pro-Israel lobbyists, and those lobbyists are now facing trial on espionage charges. Now, our partner, The New York Times, reported today that the National Security Agency intercepted telephone calls in which Congresswoman Harman said that she would push for lenient treatment for the lobbyists. Now, it's unclear when those wiretaps actually happened. And that's a look at some of the big stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. He's an adjective, Ballardian, but author J.G. Ballard is no longer with us. He died over the weekend, the post-apocalyptic sci-fi author of such books as Empire of the Sun and Crash. Joins a pantheon of authors who are also adjectives, and we're asking you about author adjectives. Come up with Dickensian, Orwellian, Shakespearean, Kafkaesque. And what about some women here?
My name is Marcella Jenkins. I'm calling from Warwick, Rhode Island. There is one woman writer whose name is an adjective. That's Sappho, and the adjective would be sapphic.
Nice. Man, those are some great listeners. 877-8-MY-TAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Patrick Henry Bass is here in the studio, Takeaway contributor and literary editor of Essence magazine, senior editor of Essence, and also author in his own right. And we're talking about the Pulitzers that were announced today, and we're going to go down the list. At the top of the list, I think just we'll begin with Lynn Nottage's play Ruined. It's the Pulitzer Prize winner for drama. It takes place in a brothel in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The play addresses a difficult subject, rape as a weapon of war. In this scene, the brothel owner Mama Nadi accuses a prostitute of trying to steal from her.
So tell me what you were planning to do with my money. Because it's my money.
I'm sorry, Mama.
No! No. I will put you out on your ass. I will make you walk naked down the road. Is that what you want? What did you think you were going to do with my money?
The Pulitzer Prize winner for drama, Ruined.
Right, and there was no surprise there. The closest competition it had was In the Heights, which is a musical set in the barrio. But that was a very brave choice for the Pulitzer board to go with Ruined, because Lynn Nottage is a writer who people have been watching for some time. I loved her play Intimate Apparel, which took place at the turn of the century and looked at an illiterate seamstress, real complicated issues. Mm-hmm. And Lynn Nottage actually went to the Congo and interviewed women who had been raped. So to bring attention to, you know, the rape and torture of women in the Congo.
A powerful play, but also very current, reminiscent of Carol Churchill's sort of looks at Eastern Europe and Romania, decades earlier.
Exactly. And Lynn Nottage is also a brilliant dramaturg. I mean, she based a lot of this on Bertolt Brecht's Mother Courage. So when you read the text, it is very layered, very complicated. So it's not like, you know, melodramatic, over the top. I mean, this is a real intelligent work.
Well, I want to get to all the titles, but what is the headline in the Pulitzer's for letters and dramas and music,
the headline is, for the first time ever, we have two African-American female winners. We have Lynn Nottage, and of course we have Annette Gordon-Reed's The Hemingses of Monticello.
Which is a great history, looking through the window of Thomas Jefferson as Sally Hemings and her family saw it living as slaves on the Monticello plantation.
Exactly, and this is a book that has not been embraced by critics. I mean, the New York Times review of it was really lukewarm. Readers really have galvanized around this book. It did go on to win the National Book Award, yes. So everyone saw that it was a favorite. Annette Gordon-Reed is an attorney who wrote about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings about 10 years ago, and that book was widely debated, you know, because she was basically saying, listen, he had this child, with at least one child with Sally Hemings, and so a lot of people question her scholarship. It's unquestionable what she's done with the Hemings is that she is a brilliant writer. It's an exhaustive work. We reviewed it in Essence magazine and heard a lot from our readers about that. And so it's really good to see a book this popular that's also been embraced by the Pulitzer Prize board.
Well, I want to give you some sense of what's in here. I mean, you know, if you read this book, you learn a lot about, it's a totally different narrative of Jeffersonian history. But in the end of Jefferson's life, he was so in debt that the issue of whether he would have freed his slaves or not was constrained by two factors. Number one, he owed so much money he couldn't afford to free his slaves. And secondly, his career would have been threatened by living with a mistress if he had freed Sally Hemings. And it's a kind of an interesting resonance with the financial crisis of today, it seems.
And also, when you go through the list of the winners, Andrew Jackson, which mirrors race and also the financial crisis.
The John Meacham book,
the Newsweek editor, you know, Andrew Jackson, the Panic of 1837, never really resolving the issue of enslavement, because you had, you know, rising tension with the abolitionists and the segregationists, especially around materials that the abolitionists were trying to distribute throughout the South, and, you know, them getting into a riot with the postmasters. And
Andrew Jackson confronting the legislature in a way that we understand in really the Bush era. Jackson was a huge sort of power broker in the White House.
Well, he was, but he focused more on banking, badly so, than he did the issue of enslavement and reconciling the nation with that.
The novel, an Oprah favorite, Olive Kittredge by Elizabeth Strout, is it positively Stroutian? It's set in Maine. It's
set in Maine.
Fabulous characters.
She's the author also of Amy and Isabel. I was surprised that that actually won,
really?
Because it had already gotten the endorsement of Oprah, and the Pulitzer Prize Board sort of shies away from those types of decisions. I was thinking A Mercy by Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison was one of only five African-American women to have won the Pulitzer Prize. Alice Walker's another one. Rita Dove, Gwendolyn Brooks, and Susan Laurie Parks. I thought that they would go with A Mercy. I thought that that was a real nice comeback for Toni Morrison after Love. Or I thought that they would go with The Plague of Doves by Louise Erdrich.
Do you think Stroud is a bad choice?
No, not at all. I was just surprised by the choice because it had already been embraced by popular critics.
You familiar with W.S. Merwin, who won?
I can't say that I am popular with Merwin.
Well, let me help you. W.S. Merwin, first of all, is a great scholar. He's a Japanese scholar, a great translator as well. And this book, I think, The Shadow of Sirius, is a bit of a lifetime achievement.
John, when did you get that book?
I bought it last night.
Okay.
But I know W.S. Merwin. He is a sweet, gentle man. And there is no poet who is a poet of aging like W.S. Merwin. Listen to this, Falling. Long before daybreak, none of the birds yet awake. Rain comes down with the sound of a huge wind rushing through the valley trees. It comes down around us all at the same time, and beyond it there is nothing. It falls without hearing itself, without knowing there is anyone here, without seeing where it is or where it is going, like a moment of great happiness of our own that we cannot remember, coasting with the lights off.
Wow, I've been hockenberried again.
Thank you. And what a great delight with my pal and your pal here on The Takeaway, Patrick Henry Bass, Takeaway contributor, literary editor of Essence Magazine. Thanks so much, Patrick. And with the passing of J.G. Ballard, you've already given us some ideas of what other authors deserve adjectives.
Hi, this is Carol from Salt Lake City. My word is Oatsian, as in Joyce Carol Oates, as in the rich but flawed people lived an Oatsian life.
That's great. Your author adjective at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We now check in with Femi Okeh, who has some headlines.
Thanks, John. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Do your jobs and we will protect you. That's what President Obama told CIA staff yesterday as details continued to emerge from the torture memos released last week.
We will protect your identities and your security as you vigorously pursue your missions. I will be as vigorous in protecting you as you are vigorous in protecting the American people.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney has been commenting on the memos. He told Fox News last night that the White House should release more CIA memos. He thinks that they will prove that what he calls intense interrogations work and actually save American lives. The Supreme Court hears a Fourth Amendment search and seizure case today about an Arizona middle school. A former middle school student says that her rights were violated when she was strip searched by school officials. That's a look at stories making news this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's the latest chapter in a long civil war in Sri Lanka. It's a brutal story and, in some sense, a bizarre story. Tamil separatist fighters ignored a surrender ultimatum by the Sri Lankan government, potentially risking the lives of tens of thousands of civilians who are unable to flee a crumbling safe haven where fierce fighting continues. We're joined by Somini Sengupta, South Asian bureau chief for The New York Times. She joins us from Delhi. Somini, what is going on and why are these people trapped in this zone in the middle of the crossfire, it seems?
Today, the ICRC called it nothing short of catastrophic. There's an estimated 50,000 civilians that are trapped in this ever-shrinking zone that is still controlled by the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, the LTTE. They have refused to let civilians out of their area, although they officially maintain that the civilians are there of their own free will. Yesterday, the Sri Lankan army broke through an earthen barrier, and tens of thousands of civilians aliens apparently came into government territory, and still more came today. This appears to be the final push, the final military assault into that last little bit of land held by the rebels.
Do the civilians have any particular allegiance? Are they inclined to associate with one side or the other, or are they completely independent in this?
It's awfully hard to tell. You know, there isn't access to independent journalists anywhere near the fighting zone. The civilians have been kept, those who have managed to get out, in camps that are guarded by the military. So it's very difficult to tell what's going on in the minds of these civilians. But remember, these are ethnic Tamil civilians who have lived in the Tamil Tiger-controlled areas for a very long time. It appears abundantly clear from the testimonies that are coming out from aid workers who are working with them that they have been held as civilian shields by the rebels.
And civilian shields whose only form of protection is to dig into the sand or hide behind logs?
Yes, they have been actually for the last several months, as fighting has intensified, these civilians have moved, some of them many, many times into what is now this really small zone in the northeast of the island. And it appears that they were clustered together in one place near this earthen barrier. The military broke through that earthen barrier. The civilians were able to spill out. I mean, the fact that they spilled out like this suggests that they didn't exactly want to be inside. This is where the most intense fighting is going on. The ICRC doesn't give any concrete numbers, but says that ongoing fighting has killed or wounded hundreds of civilians who have only minimal access to medical care.
Well, Samini, is there any chance that the international community could mediate some sort of evacuation, a pause in the fighting in the final seconds before we go?
There was last week a two-day pause in fighting declared unilaterally by the government. It called on the LTTE to let people go. The LTTE did not let its people go, and that's the situation that we have today.
A tragic situation. The brutal sort of lives in the balance, tens of thousands of civilians unable to flee a crumbling safe haven between fighting of the government of Sri Lanka and the Tamil Tigers. Samini Sengupta, South Asia Bureau Chief for the New York Times, helped us to understand what's going on there. She joined us from Delhi, India. Thank you, Samini.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Yes, that's what I said. Kafkaesque. It's completely Kafkaesque or Orwellian. In honor of J.G. Ballard, who died over the weekend, we're talking about author adjectives, and you're giving us some suggestions. Who deserves an adjective, and what does the adjective mean to you?
Larry Weisberger, on my way to work, and Thoreauvian for Paul Thoreau, who's, for some reason, the writer I've read most novels of in my life so far.
Don't we already have poetic? This is Alice from Michigan. Bye.
Oh, that's brilliant. What's your ESC or your EN 8778-MY-TAKE or MY-TAKE at thetakeaway.org? It's Tolstoyan. And here's Sonny OK with the headlines.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner testifies today before the Congressional Oversight Panel for the government's $700 billion financial rescue program. Wall Street could be grim today after a bunch of bad earnings reports hit this morning. Drug maker Merck posted a 57% drop in profits last quarter, and Coca-Cola said that its profits fell by 10%. There was also some bad news from Bank of New York, Caterpillar and DuPont as well. Mathematician and physicist Stephen Hawking is expected to make a full recovery from his chest infection. He was hospitalised yesterday and is said to be fighting a chest infection. Hawking, who's been almost entirely paralysed for years, is 67 and suffers from ALS. The United Nations cultural organization UNESCO is launching a global digital library today. It brings together material from libraries and archives across the globe. The project was actually the idea of the U.S. Library of Congress. Dr. James Billington is the veteran head of the Library of Congress.
This isn't primarily books. This is primarily one-of-a-kind documents, unique cultural treasures. There are films, some of the earliest films ever made by Lumière here in France and by Edison, of which we have all the copies in the Library of Congress. It's a free public good, and it's as nearly universal as you can get.
Are you interested? Type UNESCO World Digital Library into your search engine, and you will find it there in the 7 official UN languages, John.
Positively Orwellian there, Femi. Okay, thanks. We're joined now by Alan Beatty, World Trade Editor of the Financial Times, my favorite newspaper, and the author of False Economy, a Surprising Economic History of the World. First of all, Alan Beatty, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
You know, I think of this book as kind of a guns, germs, and steel of economics, the Jared Diamond book about interesting sort of facts about the places where civilizations began and how they determined the future course of events. We're used to thinking of economics as a kind of incremental affair where markets go up and maybe markets go down, sometimes a little more steeply, sometimes they drop off the cliff. But in general, it's an incremental narrative of the procession of economies. This book is all about enormously significant forks in the road that are significant and evident only in hindsight. Why are there so many forks in the road that aren't apparent until much, much later on?
Well, I think one of the things is that economists aren't kind of very good at analyzing history. They're not very good at analyzing narratives. They tend to think of all economies as being the same, and you do the same thing to each one and it will respond in the same way, you know? Whereas in reality, what tends to happen is countries tend to make decisions and not even necessarily being aware of those decisions. And those kind of get them on paths. And once they're on a particular path, it's kind of hard to get off it. It's not impossible to get off it, and there are kind of big significant decisions that they can take. But once you're on a path, you tend to get stuck on it. And I think it's kind of quite difficult once you're within a particular country actually to see the decisions that have been taken in the past. You know, you always tend to compare where you are with where you were rather than what right. could have happened if you'd taken a different path or, you know, where a different economy is now.
Well, one of the best stories in your book is how Argentina and the United States were actually neck and neck, sort of, at a certain point in history, and then that really, really changed, and you explore some of the reasons. Let's take a look at the U.S. and Argentina.
Yeah, I mean, back in the 19th century, you know, they were pretty much equivalent. I mean, if you look at the makeup of Argentina today, a large part of its population are Italians, and quite a few Irish as well. And you know, if you were kind of poor Italian or Irish emigrant at the end of the 19th century, it was a genuine toss-up. Were you going to go to Buenos Aires or to New York? You know, were you going to go to the Pampas or to the prairie? And they look kind of quite similar. You know, they had big temperate grasslands, very rich in natural resources, new world economy, very good at farming, and so on and so forth. And, you know, and as late as the 1930s, Argentina was one of the 10 richest economies on earth. And then, having made a couple of bad decisions, things started to go wrong, or things had actually been kind of going wrong behind the scenes for quite a long time. And as the old saying goes, you know, Argentina is the only country in history to have gone from the third world to the first and then back again.
Hmm. What were the decisions that Argentina made that were so decisive?
Well, I mean, from the beginning, the way in which it kind of settled the frontier was not particularly helpful in the sense that it essentially recreated a kind of European aristocracy with vast land holdings and so on, while the U.S. was populating it through things like the Homestead Act with these kind of small, aspirant, high productivity sort of farmers. Hmm. But, I mean, the really bad decisions it made were during the 30s when, you know, the model it had developed, which was exporting farm products to Europe, kind of collapsed because of the Depression. And from that, they drew the conclusion, well, relying on the rest of the world for trade was a mistake. We should turn in on ourselves. And so they erected these gigantic tariff walls. They said, we're going to industrialize behind these enormous kind of import tariffs. And what essentially happened is that while the rest of the world was kind of recreating the global trading system after the Second World War, they tried to go it on their own. Hmm. And they're just not big enough to do it on their own, and economies that cut themselves off just don't grow as fast anyway.
So protectionism and maintaining a landed class distinguished the U.S. and Argentina, and the U.S. has never looked back. Let's talk about natural resources for a moment. You suggest that oil, and particularly diamonds, work against democracy, and that the historical evidence for that is all over the world.
Yeah, that tends to be, on average, the kind of the outcome, that particularly if you start off with nothing else but oil or diamonds, two things tend to happen. One, it unbalances the rest of the economy because all this money floods in to buy the oil or diamonds, and that makes you uncompetitive doing anything else. And two, it tends to poison the politics of your economy because all that happens is everyone fights out with each other for control of the oil or the source of oil or diamonds. But I must say, I think if anything, the pendulum's kind of swung a bit far with this, and I think too many people now are utterly pessimistic about oil or diamonds economies and say they can never succeed. Whereas one of the contrasts I bring out in the book is between the African country of Botswana, which became independent in 1965 with almost nothing, then discovered diamonds, and then became the fastest growing economy on earth for 30 years. And you contrast that with Sierra Leone, which was actually another former British colony who also became independent, had nothing but diamonds, and then managed to succumb to a dreadful civil war and became one of the poorest economies on earth. So really, oil and diamonds on average are not good for the economy, but you can certainly choose to manage them well or choose to manage them badly.
Well, and the U.S. was a great oil producer in the early part of the 20th century. We're less so now. We still produce an enormous amount of oil, but it didn't necessarily have an anti-democratic consequence to the United States, maybe in Texas, but not in the United States broadly. Well, what decisions do you think will become those forks in the road that are being made today in this economic environment?
Well, if countries retreat to protectionism again, and I must say, just at the moment, I'm actually quite optimistic that they won't. I'm quite optimistic that we won't see a wholesale retreat to protectionism of the kind that we saw during the Great Depression. But if we do see that, that would certainly be one of those forks in the road that would take countries kind of down a low growth path. But I think the most important thing in the short term is precisely how we deal with the financial crisis, and in particular, the experience, I think, of the Depression is that when you're dealing with some extraordinary crisis like this and a massive shortfall in demand and confidence and so on, you err on the side of hitting with as much ammunition as you can, as much stimulus as you can, and you err on the side of kind of aggressive interventions into the financial system to get them going again. I think a real danger, as with Japan during the 1990s, for example, is that all the interventions are kind of too slow and that money is dribbled out year after year. And I think that will kind of cause quite a serious loss of confidence just in the overall system.
Yeah, well, speed is definitely a theme of the changes that are taking place now. Finally, you know, we've been talking about authors that become adjectives. It's really easy if you're an economist to get an adjective. Keynes, right? Keynesian?
Yeah, I'm not
what?
Sure.
How come economists get a pass here?
I'm not sure there were that. I'm trying to think of other ones which are very well known. I'm
Friedman-esque?
Not sure beyond Keynesian. Friedman-esque, you possibly Friedman-esque. I'm
anyone
not sure
suggested
that,
BDS?
I'd love to be BDS, really. If you'd like to start that as an adjective.
BTN.
I'd be happy to leap on that particular bandwagon, believe you me. But I'm not sure. And not sure enough economists are kind of household names that they're really going to become adjectives.
Well, you decide. Read False Economy. Is there an adjective Beatian? Alan Beatty is the World Trade Editor of the Financial Times and author of False Economy, A Surprising Economic History of the World. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Alan. And who else deserves an adjective?
My plug would be for the word Tolkienian, or J.R.R. Tolkien. And that would be for describing a book or movie or anything like that that has so many characters, it's way too hard and way too complex to figure out what each character has to do with the book or movie.
My head is swimming. Tolkienian. I got it. On our website, we're getting some great suggestions too. Rowlingian or Rowling-esque regarding a simple theme taking on monumental popularity, as in Harry Potter. Sarah writes, "My friends and I do use Didion-esque. We're recent J-school graduates. We adore her. Sometimes we try to emulate her, which is to say we try to write with a cool subtlety that is gentle on the surface and devastating just below." Alyssa says, "Dan Brownian, books with decent plots and really poor writing." 877-8-MY-TAKE. Keep them coming. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
I feel like I've been Hockenberry.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
His cover blown, the spies go wild. President Obama meets the CIA at Langley to an overflow crowd of spies and analysts, reassuring the spooks haunted by torture memos. Is Obama getting smarter? On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Agent 99 here. Good morning. It's Tuesday, April 21st. Coming up this hour, we'll talk about the mysterious collapse of 14 horses at the U.S. Open Polo Championships. Within 24 hours, 21 horses had died. We'll take a closer look at some of the Pulitzer Prize winners, and we'll look ahead to South Africa's elections, which begin tomorrow. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says about $110 billion are left in the government's bailout fund. It started with $700 billion in the piggy bank, expects the funds to increase by $25 billion over the next year as banks begin to pay back their loans. That's in a letter to Elizabeth Warren, the head of the Congressional Oversight Panel. Geithner will testify before the panel today. Meanwhile, a new report on the bailout program says its private-public partnership is unfair to taxpayers and favors private interests. A special inspector says it needs stronger safeguards to prevent fraud. Femi Oke is here to help me out. What else is going on, Femi?
Hello there, John. There are some disappointing earning reports out this morning. Drug maker Merck posted a 57% drop in profits last quarter. Coca-Cola said that its profits fell 10%. Construction manufacturer Caterpillar and a Bank of New York Mellon also posted results below what analysts had predicted.
And futures trading has turned completely around in the last hour.
Mm-hmm. So extremely valuable. That's what former VP Dick Cheney is calling the harsh interrogation techniques used by the CIA. He wants the agency to release new memos that show that they work.
And I've now formally asked the CIA to take steps to declassify those memos so we can lay them out there and the American people have a chance to see what we obtained and what we learned and how good the intelligence was, as well as to see this debate over the legal opinions.
The former VP also says the decision to publish the original memos was a mistake. He made his comments as President Obama visited CIA headquarters yesterday, where he defended the release of the memos. And we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. California Congresswoman Jane Harman is denying charges that she interfered with an investigation into two pro-Israel lobbyists. They're now facing trial on espionage charges. And our partner, The New York Times, reported today that the National Security Agency intercepted telephone calls in which Harman agreed to seek lenient treatment for the lobbyist, John.
We have the Somali pirate who survived the U.S. cargo ship hijacking, had a perp walk today in New York in federal court. The Dow fell 3.6% yesterday. The S&P begins trading at 832. And as we mentioned, futures are down. It looks like a negative opening on Wall Street in about 30 minutes. Adjectives for writers. You know one? Can you compete with Kafkaesque?
One adjective for a female author could be Ayn Randian for Ayn Rand. So that could lead to sentences like, though she's Iranian, her writing is quite Ayn Randian.
J.G. Ballard died over the weekend. Ballardian is an adjective. We want some female ideas for authors who could deserve to become adjectives. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As I mentioned there in the top out of the newscast, we're playing a little game here with author adjectives. And I just want to add one thing to what we've already suggested. You know, call us with your favorite author adjective. Get some women in there. You know, we got Ballardian in honor of J.G. Ballard, who died over the weekend. Ballardian means something if you're into post-apocalyptic visions. Dickensian, Kafkaesque, these are familiar. But what about some unfamiliar ones? And what about some women, for heaven's sakes? And use the adjective in a sentence for us. That's kind of clever. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We know how clever you guys are. So the president, as I've already alluded to, was all reassurance yesterday when he met with the CIA out at Langley, Virginia, at CIA headquarters.
Don't be discouraged by what's happened in the last few weeks. Don't be discouraged that we have to acknowledge potentially we've made some mistakes. That's how we learn. But the fact that We are willing to acknowledge them and then move forward. That is precisely why I am proud to be President of the United States, and that's why you should be proud to be members of the CIA.
A heartfelt pep talk from the chief executive, the commander-in-chief, out at Langley, talking to CIA officers and really responding to the revelations of the so-called torture memos from the CIA during the George W. Bush administration, which talked about waterboarding and got explicit Department of Justice approval for certain very harsh interrogation techniques. GOP and others have criticized the release of those memos, saying it undermines the CIA, but President Barack Obama has decided not to prosecute CIA employees. How reassuring was he yesterday? Art Keller joins us. He's a former CIA case officer from 1999 to 2006. He joins us from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good morning, Art.
Good morning, John.
How reassuring do you think this performance was yesterday? It was a pretty wild screaming there in the background.
I think it was very reassuring. You know, the vast majority of people at the CIA really are not field officers, and they have nothing to do with what goes on the field. But nevertheless, I think everyone gets a certain amount of fatigue over being associated with an agency that gets tarred with a bad name through when things like this break in the press. So I think, in a way, it was as much relief to people who have nothing to do with field operations, simply because you get tired of being associated with something that makes you look bad.
All right, so let's listen once again to the reception that Barack Obama and Leon Panetta, for that matter, got yesterday out at Langley.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very, very
so
much.
So, Art, you can hear in that crowd of screaming that the case officers are probably very quietly not clapping and not jumping up and down, and it's just the administrative gang?
No. I just say that because within the general body of the CIA, the Directorate of Operations, or as now known, the National Clandestine Service, is a very small part. So the bulk of CIA people, the bulk of the people who would be at such a speech at the headquarters are not the field officers, because they're out in the field.
Right, of course. And you know, they wouldn't want their cover blown, even if it is a chance to meet Barack Obama. Let's talk a little bit about the George Tenet era, something you know very, very well. It seems to me that the CIA under George W. Bush, whatever people like Vice President Cheney say, was really caught between a political battle between the Pentagon and the White House over the quality of intelligence and the political intent of intelligence. Rumsfeld on the one side was gathering resources for his own intelligence agency, while it seems like the vice president on the other side was pushing the agency to deliver results that met its political goals. First of all, can Obama dispel whatever consequences are left over from that era? And do you even buy my analysis to begin with?
Oh, no, I very much buy it. Firsthand, I saw the results of it. Can he dispel that? That will be a matter of time and trust. And I think part of his mission there yesterday was to reassure the agency and say, hey, you know, I've got your back. We're going to back off. First of all, you know, I'm going to support you, which has not been necessarily the case with the Bush administration. As you said, they viewed the agency more as a tool to present them with conclusions that were foregone conclusions that told them what they wanted to hear, at least on larger political issues. And so, I think Obama has a great opportunity to win the agency over to him, but that will depend on whether, you know, on the ground level, people feel that influence is being exerted to shape analysis or to shape how raw intelligence is greeted.
The new director of Central Intelligence, Leon Panetta, reportedly was critical of the Department of Justice decision to release the so-called torture memos, but there was none of that disagreement in evidence yesterday. What was Panetta's view? And on the issue of prosecutions, is that really Barack Obama's call? Can't Congress proceed with prosecutions no matter what Barack Obama says?
Not being a lawyer, I can't rule on that. I would say that since the kind of authorization that it takes to undertake a major policy shift or major change, that comes from something known as a presidential finding. So, you know, the president will issue a finding, and then, usually the in this case, the Office of Legal Counsel will provide legal justification to back it up. So to a certain extent, if you have a problem with what the CIA is doing, you have to confront the people who are giving them the orders and providing the justification, because I have yet to hear anyone say that engaging in these tactics was something that the CIA approached the White House about and said, we need this authority. Rather, I believe it was pushed down from the White House, who believe that that is the way the intelligence game is played. And it's historically in the U.S., that's not the way it's played.
Do you then suspect that Obama will attempt to prosecute individuals at a higher level beyond the CIA, actually reaching into the Bush White House itself?
My personal guess, and this is just, you know, kind of armchair quarterbacking the political scene, is I doubt that he will, because if you open a can of worms of going after senior people in your predecessor's administration, you leave yourself open for the same kind of attacks when you leave office.
Right. I think you're right on that one, Art. I think you're probably right on that
speaking,
one.
I think there may be a justification for going after him, but I don't know if that'll ever happen.
Well, let me shift gears here for a second. I mean, Barack Obama outlined, he said something that I think was greeted, again, very warmly there at Langley, that the CIA is more important than ever before in the post-Cold War era. And he outlined a number of missions, anti-terrorism, of course. He even got to piracy as some of the responsibility of the CIA in the intelligence mission, monitoring all of those things. Is the CIA prepared for all of those missions at this point in time?
Well, I can say at the time that I left in late 2006, it wasn't. Not because the people weren't capable. They were very capable. They were just stretched too thin. And particularly with Iraq was eating up so many of the resources of the field officers that when you have a major deployment there, it pulls from everything else. And so, hopefully as things stabilize a bit in Iraq, we can shift resources back to where they belong, which is to say the whole rest of the world, which we have to keep an eye on.
Are your former colleagues at the CIA telling you one way or another, insofar as you can confess to us or disclose to us, any sort of impressions of Leon Panetta?
You know, what's interesting is I've polled several of my colleagues, and I haven't gotten anything. In a case, this is interesting. It's the dog that didn't bark. And I'm thinking back to, when I was there in Porter Goss's tenure, and even though he was a former CIA officer, he pretty much immediately caused strife within the agency. And so I have to say this for Panetta's tenure, I haven't heard a negative word out of him. And if he was really creating waves or alienating people, that would have made the news. So at the very least, he's good. He's doing a good job in a diplomatic sense of winning over people to the extent that he is not appearing in the press. That's actually a good thing for the head of a secret agency.
And, Barack Obama described yesterday, and before we go, that he's really surrounded by former CIA folks in his national security team. I mean, you've got Robert Gates over at the Pentagon, right? And there are any number of people who are in the advisory staff on the National Security Council who come directly from the CIA. Does the CIA have a pretty good place at the table in this administration, based on your view?
I think a better place than it did in the previous administration, simply because there seemed to be, at some level, some distrust within the Bush administration of the CIA, for reasons that have been in the news many times again, a refusal to shape intelligence to say exactly the conclusion that the administration wanted.
Well, has the page turned, perhaps on the surface, but a lot remains between now and the end of this administration. My guest, Art Keller, former CIA case officer from 1999 to 2006, assessing whether Barack Obama can turn the page at Langley and the CIA and the intelligence establishment. Great reception yesterday. Good start. Thanks, Art.
Email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So Kafka got one, Orwell got one, Dickens got one, adjectives, Dickensian, Kafkaesque, Orwellian. What other authors deserve an adjective?
Hey, this is Troy from North Dakota, and I am calling to complain about my Christie-esque or Christie-N boss, whose cost-cutting techniques are so over-the-top, bizarre, and backstabbing in nature that she belongs on the Orient Express.
Agatha Christie, there's one. Tell us your adjective for an author. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email and use the adjective in a sentence, won't you? So a grim shift of gears here. It's a grim scientific mystery, but certainly the scene at the United States Open Polo Championships in Wellington, Florida on Sunday was not pleasant. Just before the start of a match, 14 top horses collapsed. Three died almost immediately. Within 24 hours, a total of 21 horses died. It's a scientific mystery. What could cause 21 horses to die seemingly instantaneously? Following the story is South Florida Sun Sentinel reporter Brian Haas. He joins us from Coconut Grove, Florida. And we're also joined by Dr. Celeste Coons, an equine veterinarian with a practice in New Jersey. Dr. Coons was formerly the chief examining vet with the New York Racing Association. Brian, Dr. Coons, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Brian, this is absolutely unprecedented in the sport and just, it seems to be in the history of animals. What could possibly have happened here and how is it being covered down in South Florida?
You are correct. I mean, this is unprecedented. I spoke to Peter Rizzo, the head of the U.S. Polo Association, and he's just dumbfounded by this. What you have going on right now is you have necropsies going on at the University of Florida and at a state animal laboratory trying to figure out what killed them from their tissue samples, from their blood samples. At the same time, you've got scientists taking a look at their feed, at their water, at any vitamin supplements they may have been given, just to see if something there may have been toxic. They've basically, at this point, they think they've ruled out infectious disease, anything that could spread, and they're pretty sure that there was something that they came in contact with that was limited to this group of horses.
Well, putting this in context was Dr. Scott Swerdlin, who is a veterinarian on scene at the Polo Club on Sunday after this happened. I mean, he was very blunt.
These are the best horses in the world. If you were looking at athletes, it would be like a plane crash of the greatest football players in the world.
Dr. Celeste Coons, what could conceivably explain 21 horses dying so suddenly?
Well, sudden death is rare in the horse anyway, and this was a cluster. And apparently, from what I understand, 100% mortality. Not one horse was able to be saved. You know, no external wounds. It had to be same exposure, same time frame. The first thing that pops in your mind from my area is Monensin toxicity. We had about 20 years ago in the state of New Jersey. It was a feed mill error, and there was a colorless, odorless additive in the feed, and the horses died very quickly. It was a myocardial necrosis. That, if that happened, that should be found. They would examine the stomach contents and the muscle tissue. Other things that come to mind, toxic vegetation, but these horses were not on pasture. There could be arsenic would be unlikely in pesticides. They'd have to be exposed to so much of it, and that would be more of a gastrointestinal problem. Blister beetle ingestion and hay, they'd have to eat so many of them, but that would be something easily found. Moldy corn poisoning, that would affect the white matter of the brain. You may see some dizziness and ataxia, which they did see. Again, kind of unlikely. Clostridial spores, you would see more of a bloody diarrhea. I don't believe they saw that at all. Carbon monoxide, it's too open. Those areas are very well ventilated. Organophosphates, again. Lead poisoning in the water, unlikely. Very unlikely, but possible. Warfarin toxicity, they should have a coagulation disorder. You know, these, if we were, the unfortunate thing is, you know, if these were, if this was a barn of school horses that died suddenly, horses that were only going to planning on going trail riding the next day, our list would be a little different. But one of the possible causes that would we'd have to include here is a tainted pre-competition substance.
Right.
Now.
Well, let me just ask Brian Haas for a moment. Has foul play been ruled out? I mean, is there a possible question of sabotage here?
I don't believe anything has been ruled out, and sabotage is possible, but extremely unlikely. You know, first of all, the timing was poor. It was too close to a big event. It would be much easier if it was in the middle of the week, and there's more scrutiny around these horses right before an event. And access to the horses, it's a closed herd, the personnel. These people, I spent time in Argentina with the thoroughbreds down in San Isidro and Palermo, and you know, these people live with them. They eat with them. This is a national tragedy.
Right. Let me get a final word from Brian Haas. Are the authorities investigating this at this point? Is there a police investigation underway?
Yeah, yesterday in the afternoon, both the state Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services and the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office, which patrols Wellington, both opened law enforcement investigations. Up to that point, it had been mostly a scientific inquiry to find out what was going on. But because of the magnitude of it, they did open law enforcement investigations. They've not ruled out foul play,
right.
But they say, at least as of late yesterday, that there was no evidence of foul play at that point.
Well, we have to go, but I can certainly hear the shock in both of your voices. Just to remind our listeners, within 24 hours at the United States Open Polo Championships in Wellington, Florida on Sunday, 21 championship polo horses died. It's still a scientific mystery. We may find out what's going on, as Brian Haas says. Nothing's been ruled out at this point. I want to thank my guests, Brian Haas, reporter for the South Florida Sun Sentinel in Palm Beach County, Florida, and Celeste Coons, an equine veterinarian with a practice in New Jersey, formerly chief examining veterinarian at the New York Racing Association. Thanks to you both. Quickly, author adjectives still coming in. Ben emails us. I wonder if Beckettian or Beckett-esque is used less frequently, because it should simply be, because both words are so awkward to say, as I'm demonstrating here, so difficult to figure out where the emphasis is meant to lie. Samuel Beckett, Beckett-esque? Are the headlines Beckett-esque, Femi, okay?
I could make them completely absurd, and then they
you
would
could.
Be.
Yes.
But then that would be like most other days. Good morning, everybody. 29 minutes past the hour. Former Vice President Dick Cheney says that the CIA should release more memos. That's what he told Fox News last night as he was defending harsh interrogation tactics. While Cheney is now calling for the release of more memos, he also said the White House shouldn't have published the original memos last week. The U.S. military is shifting resources from Iraq to Afghanistan. The U.S. Army is sending 500 engineers to Afghanistan who specialize in clearing roads and explosives. This is the largest transfer so far of personnel and equipment from Iraq. Talks between North and South Korea are delayed. Officials from the two nations were supposed to meet in a border town some hours ago, but a unification official says that they still can't agree on where to meet or what to discuss or who will be at the talks. I've been to meetings like that, and that's a look at some of the big stories.
Thank you, Femi.
Making news this morning.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Author J.G. Ballard died over the weekend. His immortality is assured. Before his death, the Collins English Dictionary had added Ballardian. It's an author adjective that means sort of bleak, man-made, dystopian, post-apocalyptic, you know, Ballardian. Who else deserves an adjective?
Dostoevskian. Not because it means anything, but it makes you sound so intelligent and it sounds so good. Dostoyevskian.
Smart dude. Yeah. Tell us your suggestion for author adjectives and come up with some females, won't you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Some congratulations are in order this morning for the city of Detroit and some other places around the country. The Pulitzers were announced yesterday, which causes us to remember this voice. Recognize it?
After much deliberation with my family, after numerous prayers and fasting, I have made the difficult decision, I believe the most difficult decision of my life, to step down.
Former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. It all began with text messages, an affair, a sex scandal, a trial, prison, removal from office. But the whole story began with stories in the Detroit Free Press, which were awarded Pulitzers yesterday. M.L. Elric, reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner for 2009 from the Detroit Free Press, joins us from Detroit, Michigan. M.L. Elric, thanks for being with us.
John, I love the way that sounds. Could you say that again, M.L. Elric, Pulitzer Prize winner?
M.L. Elric, reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner for 2009. Are you listening, Mrs. Elric?
I'm never going to get tired of hearing that.
Now, you share this with a colleague of yours. Give us his name.
That's Jim Schaefer, and actually there were a lot of
people. No, ML, you got to say Jim Schaefer, Pulitzer Prize winner.
It sounds better when you say it, John.
Also joining us is Ryan Gabrielson, staff writer, and also 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner from the East Valley Tribune for a very different story. He joins us from Phoenix, Arizona. Ryan, congratulations.
Thanks for having me on, I agree. That sounds very, very nice.
Now, you share your prize with someone who actually tells a pretty gripping story about newspapers themselves. Describe who you share the prize with.
My reporting partner, Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Giblin, was part of a mass layoff in January at the East Valley Tribune. We shed about 40% of our staff and went from being a 7-day-a-week daily to only a 4-day-a-week daily.
Wow. A number of stories there. But let's talk about the importance in your communities of the stories that you told. We mentioned Kwame Kilpatrick there for a moment and M.L. Elric, Pulitzer Prize winner for 2009. I'll get back to you in a moment. Ryan, what was the story that you broke and what was the significance in the community?
We conducted an investigation of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office, which has largely converted its police force into an immigration enforcement agency. And they're doing massive crackdowns on day laborers and hugely Hispanic neighborhoods. And so with all the resources going into that, we wanted to see what impact that was having on everything else that they were doing. And as it turns out, that they were ignoring a great many violent crime case investigations, closing rapes without ever actually conducting investigations. The response times had slowed dramatically. Overall arrest rate went from 10% to around 3% in
Wow.
2 years.
So focusing on immigrant issues, creating, in a sense, an immigrant empire at the expense of other sort of law enforcement responsibilities. Here's Sheriff Arpaio on ABC News.
You're looking at tents. You're looking at the inmates in the tents. They're all convicted, doing their time. They're wearing pink underwear, striped uniforms, and it's 148 degrees here last month.
Now, what was Sheriff Arpaio describing there, Ryan?
He was talking about his tent cities and potentially a recent decision by his office to shift known illegal immigrants in his jails to the tents, to a separate area of the tents. I mean, we really want to do with our investigation, because he's very well known for the persona of America's toughest sheriff, and we wanted to separate that out and look at how his office actually operated versus what the rhetoric was.
An inside look. M.L. Elric, is this a Pulitzer for gotcha of Kwame Kilpatrick, or is there a deeper story about the relationship between the mayor's office and the community of Detroit?
Well, this is a public watchdog story. This is about holding government accountable in a way that only newspapers can. And ultimately, while the mayor did lie about having sex, it was the lying that brought him down, because it was perjury, in fact. And the real tragedy, when people talk about the tragedy of Kwame Kilpatrick, is that he abused the public trust. He lied to us, he used our money to cover it up, and he, as far as I can tell, never felt a little bit guilty about it.
And, the consequence of your story and the long and, terrible decline of Kwame Kilpatrick is a real sense of cynicism about public institutions in Detroit. How can the newspaper help turn that around?
We can give people someone to believe in. We can give someone to trust. I mean, when you look at the work that my colleague on the other line did. He fought the law, and the law lost. I mean, he went up against somebody powerful. The free press went up against somebody powerful. And it's that ability to say, look, these guys are telling you one thing. We're going to find out what the real deal is, and we're going to have the guts to publish it, and then you can decide who you think is right. Well, in Detroit, they believe we're right.
Right. Well, Ryan and ML Eric, Elric, congratulations to both of you. Where are you headed now, Disneyland?
I think New York.
Oh, terrific.
I'm going back to work because one of my colleagues may be sent to jail today by a federal judge because he's refusing to reveal his source on a story that was 100% accurate. So there's good news, and then the next day it's troubling news.
Well, I have to use the good news to keep the attention on the troubling news so that people are aware of what's going on out there.
Well, it's so great to talk to both of you. My guest, Ryan Gabrielson, staff writer and also a 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner from the East Valley Tribune in Phoenix, and M.L. Elric, reporter and Pulitzer Prize winner for 2009 from the Detroit Free Press. Thanks, and congratulations to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks, John, and we love having your show on here in Detroit.
Oh, you're beautiful. And now Femi Okay with the headlines for all of you in Detroit and the rest of the country. Femi?
Hello, Detroit. Good morning, everybody. So I have a lot of news about the financial bailout this morning. The Treasury Department says that there's only $106 billion left from the government's $700 billion bailout plan. Now, officials think the bailout fund will get a boost next year as some of the banks they loaned money pay them back. Secretary Timothy Geithner has to answer to the Congressional Oversight Panel today. Meanwhile, a government report to Congress says that the bailout plan favors private investors and could be unfair to taxpayers. And capping that news, the IMF has doubled its predictions for how much money U.S. financial firms will lose in the global crisis. The IMF now estimates that U.S. firms will lose $2.7 trillion. President Obama has asked his cabinet heads to trim $100 million from their administrative budgets, but Senator Mitch McConnell says that number is paltry. He says that, to put it into context, that's what we spend every day on interest for the stimulus package. And overseas, where following the beginnings of the South African elections, they start tomorrow. It will be the 15th anniversary of fully democratic elections in South Africa. The ANC is the party that's expected to win. We will bring you all of that news tomorrow during the South African elections.
That will make President Jacob Zuma, correct?
He will, yeah. That's ahead of the ANC, so if they win, he becomes president.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. A day after Barack Obama travels to the CIA to reassure them about the American security mission around the world, another computer spy story from our friend Siobhan Gorman, the Wall Street Journal's intelligence correspondent. Computer spies have reportedly broken into the Pentagon's $300 billion Joint Strike Fighter project. It's the Defense Department's costliest weapons program ever. And Siobhan, first of all, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Out there in San Francisco, thanks for being a part of the program. And is this about trying to rip off the design or develop countermeasures to shoot the plane down?
Well, probably both. Not necessarily countermeasures to shoot the plane down necessarily, although we don't always know what the motives are. But the concerns about that intelligence officials have about this are threefold, as I understand it. One is that they did leave behind little software tools that might allow them to disrupt the system in the future if in the cleanup process the Pentagon didn't necessarily get rid of all of them. Two is that if you rip off the design, then you obviously know the inherent limitations of a program. And three, if you rip off a design, you can also copy it and perhaps use it yourself.
So cyber intruders, what did they actually enter? Is it some computer that actually designs the plane, or is it the email accounts of the designers and engineers that are working on the project?
Well, it is the design of the plane. The plane itself is kind of divided into at least two components, and it didn't get into the most sensitive systems, the true guts of the plane itself. What it got into, as far as we understand it, is this sort of logistical component of the program, which is what makes this particular plane special and unique. It's that it has this capability to diagnose while it's in flight what problems are, what maintenance problems, what needs to be dealt with. So once it gets to the ground, those can be dealt with immediately. So if you can imagine, it's sort of the equivalent of you going to the doctor and somebody else being able to control what the doctor says.
Well, very sophisticated technology. Who is suspected of being the intruder here?
China. China is commonly sort of fingered in these things, but in the case of the Joint Strike Fighter, there's been an investigation that's been going on since at least last year by the Air Force, and it sounds like they've found, sort of the equivalent of digital fingerprints and internet protocol addresses that have been used in the past by China in their experience to attack U.S. systems. China argues in this case and in other cases that it's very easy to fake your identity in cyberspace. And so, China says, no, we're not doing this. It's somebody who's pretending to be us.
Well, finally, Siobhan, is it possible that the supplier network for this $300 billion Joint Strike Fighter project includes Taiwanese, even Chinese companies?
It is possible. Often, one of the big problems in cybersecurity matters is actually that it's very hard to know who all is involved in a supply chain, particularly with a project that's this complex. I mean, it involves contractors in 9 different countries, certainly not specifically China, but there are suppliers to these contractors, and it's very hard to control such a disparate network of contractors.
Well, another fantastic story. Siobhan Gorman, the Wall Street Journal's intelligence correspondent, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
She broke the story of computer spies reportedly breaking into the Pentagon's $300 billion Joint Strike Fighter project. That's the Defense Department's costliest weapons program ever.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's all so bloody Ballardian, you know? J.G. Ballard died over the weekend. The British author, around for 50 years, had a body of work that made him immortal, but he also had an adjective in his own name. What other authors deserve an adjective?
Hi, I'd like to nominate Stelium after Danielle Steele, the romance author, meaning syrupy, treacly, romantic. For example, the romance novel was so Stelium that it was an instant bestseller among chicklet people.
Stelium, love it. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email, author adjectives to mytake@thetakeaway.org. And now Femi Okeh has some headlines.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. Earlier this morning, parts of Israel came to a standstill as a siren marked the day. The annual event is held in memory of the millions of Jews who died during the Holocaust. Memorial events are being held in Germany and Poland, and here in the United States, the biggest event takes place in D.C. at the Holocaust Memorial Museum. California Congresswoman Jane Harman says that she did not interfere with an investigation into 2 pro-Israel lobbyists. Those lobbyists now face espionage charges. The National Security Agency intercepted calls in which Congresswoman Harman said that she would push for lenient treatment for the lobbyists, and it's not quite clear when those phone calls took place. Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius faces a Senate committee vote today on whether to confirm her as the next health secretary. It's expected to go through, although some Republicans have raised questions about accounts, about her accounting discrepancies, in campaign contributions she received from a late term abortion doctor. Now, a full Senate vote could come within days. That's a look at stories making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Today is the last day of campaigning before South Africans head to the polls. The African National Congress leader, Jacob Zuma, is a sure bet to win. But the torch is passing in South Africa. 15 years ago, Nelson Mandela swept to an historic victory to become the first black president of South Africa. And here's Mandela back in 1994.
We have received the provisional results of the election. My friends, I can tell you that we are delighted by the overwhelming support for the African National Congress.
15 years later, there's still solid majority support for the ANC. Is it overwhelming? Well, here to talk about this passing of the torch and the very different moment in South African politics today versus 15 years ago is Dan Simpson, former director of Southern African Affairs in the State Department. He joins us from member station WDUQ in Pittsburgh. Dan and Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. It's nice to be with you.
What is the U.S. interest in this campaign, and how different is a Jacob Zuma from a Nelson Mandela?
Well, the U.S. interest in South Africa is longstanding and evident. South Africa is a regional power. South Africa is certainly the world power from Africa. And finally, the United States has had close relations with South Africa for many years. We would like to see stability in the country, obviously peace. We would like to see good, orderly elections. And finally, we'd like to see a healthy economy because South Africa is, in fact, the African nation which can pull the train in Africa in terms of economic development. Well, it's a mixed – go ahead.
Well, what issues are very, very important and that the U.S. would be counting on South Africa to play a mediating role? Is it Rwanda? Is it Angola? Is it Tanzania? Is it the situation in Zimbabwe?
It's Zimbabwe, but more than that, you raised the question in the lead into this by mentioning that South Africa had gone from Nelson Mandela, who did his very best and was somewhat successful in healing the wounds between white and black in South Africa, who was then followed by Thabo Mbeki, who probably concentrated most of all on the economy and then was turned out by his party, the African National Congress. And there's been a temporary president, Kgalema Motlanthe, and now it appears that he will be succeeded by Jacob Zuma. There's a lot of question about Zuma. He has a little education, and he has a reputation for being flamboyant, and people are a bit afraid that this flamboyance will, in practice, as he governs, turn into even irresponsibility in terms of peace and quiet in South Africa.
Although that flamboyance on some level is a kind of a populist, gives him a bit of a populist folk hero status. I mean, it doesn't necessarily hurt him in the polls in the way it might Bill Clinton here in the United States. But let's listen to the voice of a young student at Johannesburg University that the Associated Press put on their audio wire earlier this week. This is a fellow by the name of Morris Nchachi, and he describes from his perspective as a new voter what the choices are. The ANC has a troubled reputation in his view. Listen to this.
The ANC did fight for their democracy for the past 97 years, but then they took less than 15 to destroy it as well.
The 15 years that you describe between Mandela to Mbeki to now Zuma, this young person describes as the destruction of South Africa.
Well, this is one of those, is the glass half full or the glass half empty. I mean, if one looks at Zimbabwe, which had a comparable, although not identical, history and ethnic pattern as South Africa, South Africa has done marvelously well. In terms of economic development, political stability, playing a generally responsible role in the region. Although, to flip back to your previous point, they've done very badly on Zimbabwe. They have not stepped up to the plate in trying to bring an end to the absolute chaos that reigns in Zimbabwe. I think the African National Congress will win against the Democratic Alliance and the Congress of the People. Those two parties, I mean, the Democratic Alliance has got too many whites in it from the point of view of the 80% black South Africans. Congress of the People is a splinter group from the ANC, and I don't think it has a snowball's chance of winning. So Zuma's going to win. And then the question will be, how does one, you know, how does he govern? And also, how does the rest of the world gently steer him into a position of responsible leadership, both on the economic level and on the political level and the regional level?
Well, what's the narrative going forward for the ANC, which is now a big ruling party? I mean, is it going to be the LDP path, like in Japan? Is it going to be the PRI path, the Revolutionary Party in Mexico? Or is it going to be ZANU-PF to the north, which, of course, is the horrible story?
Well, you know, after 35 years as a diplomat, I feel very strongly that each country writes its own script. And I think that South Africa is writing its own script based on its unique history and the unique combination of ethnic and racial groups that make up its population, and particularly its history. I mean, if you think about it, all those years of apartheid, you know, rigid segregation, and then 1994 comes the dawn, you know. And I mean, and that, of course, is still the basic problem that torments South Africa. You know, the wealth of the country is still disproportionately in the hands of whites, whereas 80% of the population are black. And so, you know, this is not, and on many, many of the blacks are still poor, even after 15 years of majority rule. So that's the basic problem.
And these are serious, serious issues. I mean, the domestic agenda.
Easy.
Right, and Jacob Zuma will face them on day one. Lots to talk about. Dan Simpson, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure, John.
Former Director of Southern African Affairs in the State Department, Dan Simpson joined us from WDUQ Public Radio in Pittsburgh. We're turning to you to coin some new literary phrases. Author J.G. Ballard died over the weekend, but even before his death, there was Ballardian, an adjective, meaning resembling or suggestive of dystopian modernity. Who else deserves an adjective?
DJ from New Jersey. Oscarian from Oscar Wilde. He is so quotable. Hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil, and you'll never be invited to a party.
Hey, my name is Patrick McLean. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I have another author adjective for you. Mametian. Do you know what I'm saying? I'm saying it. Do you know it? I am saying it. It's dialogue that works like that.
Mametian for David Mamet. That's fabulous. Tell us your adjective and what it means by going to our website, thetakeaway.org, like Mark did, who suggests Bukowskian. He says it's for Charles Bukowski's doomed, drunk, beyond redemption stance and LA-centric prose and poetry. Come up with your authorial adjective, all right? Make it Kafkaesque. Those are my favorite. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.